Education in the 1780s was really about the Sunday school movement, which was basically a philanthropic or charitable exercise triggered by a moral panic about the working class and the activities of their children in society. This can be seen, I think, as the precursor of mass schooling, and it offered for many people the only formal education that they were to receive, formal in the sense of a schooling system. And its task was seen very much as an attempt to civilise and spiritualise the poor by teaching them the good old principles of religion. Now, a second interesting development is between 1803 and 1818, and this was the development of the monitorial schools, which you've probably seen pictures of in your school history books. These were the schools of Bell and Lancaster, the two people that both claimed to have invented them, I think, and they provided the first form of mass schooling. These schools were seen, in their terms, as massive engines of improvement, as Wally Preston would also say, as intellectual factories. They're the terms they used. These were the places where working class children were to be herded and where they were going to learn the three R's and, of course, a lot more besides that. However, the method of teaching was in some ways as important as the content. Children were seated in rows. They moved only by command, and they were kept busy to prevent them from indulging in that unproductive activity called play. In Lancaster School, in fact, talking was considered to be an offence, as no doubt thinking was. Richard Johnson, who's written a lot on this topic, and I don't think he's on the reading list, but he's certainly written a lot on this area, he thinks that this is the most coercive and the most negative movement in the whole history of education. And if you know what happens in the history of education, that's saying quite a lot. So it was during the period between 1820 and 1840 that the schooling enterprise really takes off and buildings begin to grow in size and take on the characteristics of institutions designed for the masses. The liberal middle class at the time, or the philosophical radicals, people like Mills, Bentham, Francis Place, began to attack the old monitorial system as being inefficient, realising the need to develop a national system of secular education administered by a board and an inspectorate. And at this time, two very important institutions developed, which I want to look at. Firstly, it's quite a mouthful, the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge, which was set up by Lord Henry Brougham, I think that's how you pronounce it, I'm not probably educated. I'm going to call him Brougham. In 1826. That's the first institution that I'm going to say a few things about. And the second one was the Mechanics Institutes. Now, the basic idea behind these institutions was that useful knowledge, and that's the term they use, useful knowledge, was knowledge that was practical and instrumental in the business of life. The old religious explanations of the natural and social world were being eroded by the development of science at this time, and scientific facts and principles, they argued, needed to be made freely available to a wider possible audience as they could manage. And if you want to see this parodied, look at Charles Dickens' book, novel Hard Times. I don't know if any of you have read that, but in that he parodies this idea of fact grinding, and appropriate enough, the teacher is called Mr. Chocum Child, which is fairly appropriate. Now, the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge was concerned with three things. Firstly, with the acquisition of technical and scientific knowledge. Secondly, with providing useful and sober reading material. And to this end, it produced, firstly, the Library of Useful Knowledge. Later on, it produced the Library of Entertaining Knowledge, and finally it produced the Penny Magazine, which was designed as innocent amusement for the working class. And if you know anything about the radical press in Britain, you'll realise why they were producing this type of material. So that was the second thing that he was concerned with. The third thing was instruction into the scientific truths of political economy. This began in the 1830s with the aim of enlightening people about their position in society, which was determined, of course, by natural economic laws, which proved, of course, that inequality was in fact inevitable. Now, Charles Knight wrote a number of pamphlets on this subject. He wrote an address to labourers on the subject of destroying machinery in 1830. This was followed by The Results of Machinery in 1831, and finally a book called Capital and Labour in 1831 as well. Now, if Charles Knight wasn't a Knight before he wrote The Results of Machinery, he certainly should have been made one afterwards, because in this book he gives advice to workers about what to do if their wages fall. And I quote from that. He says, "When there's too much labour in the market and wages are too low, do not combine to raise the wages. Do not combine with the vain hope of compelling the employer to pay more for labour than there are funds for the maintenance of labour, but go out of the market. You have, in too many cases, nothing but your labour for support. We say to you, get something else. Acquire something to fall back upon. When there's a glut of labour, go out at once of the market, become yourself capitalists," which is very good advice to give workers, I suppose. Now, the second institution I mentioned were the mechanics institutes. These provide perhaps the best illustration of the idea of useful knowledge and its diffusion. And they appeared in almost every sizeable British town in the 1840s. Their original aim was to teach an elementary science-based curriculum to mechanics, skilled artisans, and operatives. And they taught in these institutions maths, chemistry, drawing, and the principles of mechanics. At this time, controversial religious, political, and economic ideas and books were banned from the institute's libraries. They wouldn't have them. It's worth mentioning as well that the mechanics institutes failed to attract the expected workers, and they eventually became agencies for what they called rational recreation, moving away from a science-based curriculum, more to do with culture and literary subjects. So far what I think I've established is that mass schooling began in the 1780s, and by the 1840s it's certainly taken off. Now, the important question that needs to be asked is, what were the motives behind this sudden surge of interest in education? What was behind this sudden obsession with putting the working class into schools? I think schooling can be seen as a quite specific response to a problem which is clearly expressed in the writings of Edwin Chadwick and Dr. James Philip Kay, who later became Kay Shuttleworth. Kay was the chief educational policy maker of the government in the 1840s, and prior to this, in 1832, he'd produced a pamphlet called The Moral and Physical Condition of the Working Classes Employed in Cotton Manufacturing in Manchester. In this, he paints a terrifying picture of the working class, which is not too dissimilar from the picture that's painted in Albert Square in the EastEnders. According to this picture he paints, people here are involved in crime, prostitution, drunkenness, poverty. They're also indulging in riots and machine breaking. Now, the danger here that they perceived was that this uneducated mob, this irrational mob, was childlike in its mentality, and it was being easily misled by radicals, and it was becoming in fact ungovernable. Fairly predictably, I suppose, the rising capitalist class looked around for someone to blame, and they hit on the jolly clever idea of blaming the workers themselves. The workers were responsible for their own poverty. It was a product of their behaviour, a product of their way of life. Kay says in his pamphlet, "It's melancholy to perceive how many of the evils suffered by the poor flow from their own ignorance and moral errors." So this is a condemnation of the working class. And this type of statement is quite common, and it appears time and time again, and it stems from a fundamental belief that the working class are somehow intellectually and morally defective. They were referred to quite often as the ignorant class. Their thinking was seen to be superficial and sensual, as opposed to being deep and rational like their masters. John Foster wrote an article which was called An Essay on the Evils of Popular Ignorance. In it he writes, "The working class mind, there's the perfect non-existence in their minds have any notion or question what their life is for, taken as a whole. Their heads are full of trifling and corrupting ideas. So the basic problem that these people were picking up on at this time was ignorance, working class ignorance. If only the working class could be taught new patterns of behaviour, they wouldn't live in poverty anymore and they wouldn't be so easily influenced by crazy agitators. And again, if you want to see this view expressed clearly, have a look at some of the novels that came out, which were referred to as the dealing with the condition of England question. For example, Elizabeth Gatskill, in her book Mary Barton, says this: "The actions of the uneducated seem to me typified in those of Frankenstein, that monster of many human qualities, ungifted with a soul, a knowledge of the difference between good and evil." Similarly, if you look at Disraeli's book, or his novel, called Sybil, in this he paints a picture of a working class mob who eventually raid a castle, and of course the first thing they do when they get into the castle is they go down into the cellar and get absolutely pretty drunk. And what follows after this is these grimy ruffians, as he refers to them, they go on an orgy of destruction and they sort of stamp on paintings and they tear up books and, you know, they've got no idea of what's valuable and important in life. Historically then, I think mass schooling was about trying to restore social harmony in capitalist society. A situation where the working class, of course, was still robbed blind, but they didn't complain too much about it because it was all part of the grand scheme of things. The working classes needed to be incorporated into the capitalist system. They needed to learn to respect private property and the reasons why they didn't have any. Schooling was seen very much in terms of an investment, a way of protecting private property. It was a self-interested response and it was nothing to do with providing social justice for the people. Harrison, in this book, Learning and Living and Learning, which is out of print now, but you can still get it through the library, he says, "The schools were not the people's institutions, but rather instruments for shaping society according to the dominant middle class's views." So education for the working class meant confinement in institutions where young people were condemned to be taught. So when a government inspector was asked in Parliament, this is a question, "What is the nature and height of the fence with which the playground is enclosed?" You can be sure that he was concerned about people getting out rather than children trying to get in. Now, because schooling was seen as a way of civilising the masses, it necessarily involved a vicious attack on working class culture, which was presented as barbarous, indecent and decadent. This attack is to be found documented in reports of government inspectors, and it takes in just about every facet of working class life. They looked. They criticised sports, amusements, language, literature, their drinking habits, their smoking, their political and economic opinions, even their songs were criticised. This lifestyle, of course, that the working class had established was an attempt to deal with the new conditions in which they found themselves. Their old communities had been destroyed, along with many of their cultural traditions, which were deeply rooted in the countryside. All of that was changed when they're being pushed out of the countryside into these large towns. Working class culture was seen to be obstructing progress, and it had to be replaced with a new community ethic, a new morality of subservience. Anyway, the virtues preached by these hypocrites were designed to produce a new race of workers who were punctual, industrious, sober, clean, obedient and thrifty. Kay even thought that working class songs might be used, I quote, "to inspire cheerful views of industry and to associate amusement with duties." And if you read Engels' book of the conditions people were living in, you see how ridiculous that is. Now to the nub of the matter, really, we need to ask, what were the workers doing themselves? How were they educating themselves at this time? And what response did they have to this imposition, this schooling enterprise? Now, this is a largely unwritten story about the efforts of ordinary people to develop their own educational traditions from their own point of view. It's about the struggle to develop an independent social and political outlook on society. In this sense, early 19th century radicalism and the search for knowledge were inseparable. They went together. As they saw an understanding of society was the way in which you could change it. Radical working class ideas were a response to their material conditions that they were experiencing. The poverty, the political oppression, the economic crisis, the political struggle that people were engaged in provides the inescapable background to their efforts to educate themselves. So, what were the characteristics of radical education? Well, the first point that needs to be made is that we have to keep things in perspective. We need to be aware that no matter how significant and important these ideas are, they were part of a very small movement. They were a minority tradition, in actual fact. And it's not too difficult to understand why that was the case, given the social conditions under which the autodidact struggled to acquire knowledge. It was a time when working people had very little leisure, when work was often physically exhausting, and when there was hardly enough money to survive on, let alone to buy luxuries like books and extra candles. Given this context, this historical context, the documented accounts of those people who did make efforts to educate themselves politically makes impressive and often quite astonishing reading. Let me give you a couple of examples. Thomas Cooper, the Leicester Chartist, he worked as a cobbler from 7 in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. He would then read for 3 hours until midnight, sleep for 3 hours, and then get up to fit in another 4 more hours before returning to his workbench at 7. Another example was William Lovett, the Chartist leader, who tells of his experiences of coming into contact with a group of self-educated workers in London. I quote, he says, "My mind seemed to be awakened to a new mental existence. New feelings, hopes and aspirations sprang up within me, and every spare moment was devoted to the acquisition of some kind of useful knowledge." Now, the autodidact, or the self-educated person, had a burning passion for acquiring knowledge of all sorts. They would often build up small libraries of cheap books and pamphlets. They would often build up collections of fossils, plants and insects, because naturalism was one of the areas they were interested in. One of the more cranky subjects they indulged in at this time was phrenology, which was considered to be a new science of the mind, where you'd read the lumps on a person's skull and that would tell you something about their mental characteristics. There was a reference to this recently, actually, when I was preparing this on Coronation Street. Thought it might interest you. Anyway, E.P. Thompson, in his book The Making of the English Working Class, says, "The autodidact had often an uneven, laboured understanding, but it was his own. Since he had been forced to find his intellectual way, he took little on trust. His mind didn't move within the established ruts of formal education." Now, radical education did something else that was important. It presented a radical critique of all the forms of provided education that I mentioned earlier. The Sunday schools, the monitorial schools, the mechanics institutes, all of those were criticised, and rightly so. They were treated with varying degrees of suspicion, distrust and hostility, as they weren't considered to be the people's institutions. They were something imposed from above. These institutions didn't offer working people liberation. They threatened subjection, in actual fact. So, along with the three R's, the radicals warned of the three S's: civility, slavery and surveillance, that went on in schools. Radical education was, of course, concerned with alternative goals as well. And Brian Simon, which is, if you are interested in this topic, his three books, Studies in the History of Education, are probably the best ones to get hold of. He says, "The whole conception of education in the radical tradition is based on quite different foundations and has opposite objectives. Knowledge needed to be political in that it was needed to change society, and this is clearly brought out by looking a little closer at the term useful knowledge. The phrase useful knowledge invites the obvious question, useful to whom and for what purposes. The working class radicals were quick to see through the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge's plans, which they argued were designed to make workers better servants. They were going to be taught knowledge which would make their bosses profits, would make them as workers more productive. The Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge, I'll just call it the Society from now on, I think, was ridiculed for promoting irrelevant, trivial and useless knowledge. Jokes were often made about it in the radical press. For example, Wyatt was asked, didn't the lass Victoria learn really useful knowledge by being apprenticed to a milliner? And one editor of a radical press produced a one-off comic magazine which was designed for the diffusion of broad grins, which again is mirroring the term that was used. The Society's view on political economy was seen as insulting and was treated with contempt. And with reference to Charles Knight, who I mentioned earlier, this is what appeared in the Poor Man's Guardian. In conformity with the advice of Lord Brougham and the Useful Knowledge Society, the Milton fishermen, finding their occupations gone, have resolved to become capitalists forthwith. Another article from the Poor Man's Guardian puts it quite well, I think. It says, the juggle of the political economist is now seen through. When translated into plain English, political economy means nothing more than this. Give up the whole produce of your labour, fill everybody's cupboard but your own, and then starve quietly. It goes on, no, the wealth producers must obtain useful knowledge of a very different description if they desire to change their condition. So at this stage you can see that the radical working class had their own ideas about what constituted useful knowledge, and they coined the phrase really useful knowledge. According to the Chartist Northern Star, that was knowledge which it's ever been the study of our tyrants to withhold from us. They wanted political knowledge at this time which was relevant to their experiences and problems, knowledge about their position in society. As the Owenite paper, The Pioneer, put it, all useful knowledge consists of the acquirement of ideas concerning our conditions in life. And again, according to the Poor Man's Guardian, what we want to be informed about is how to get out of our present troubles, knowledge calculated to make us free. Now, an essential part of really useful knowledge was the emphasis placed on science and natural history as a means of understanding society. This can be seen as a continuation of the 18th century Enlightenment, which believed that human progress could be explained in terms of intellectual development and the triumph of reason. Scientific knowledge, it was argued, held the key to the future, as it was the knowledge they required to change society. And there are some illustrations of this. For example, there were Owenite halls of science sprang up in the late 1830s with the aim of providing both natural and social science to the workers. In the 1850s, the ideas of positivism made an important intellectual impact through the work of a group of London positivists who were the followers of the French originator of the term, Comte. Positivism was regarded as a new religion of humanity, and the London positivists established a Church of Humanity in Holborn. The positivists saw their role as intellectual advisors to the labour movement, and eventually they became incorporated into the Fabian tradition in the 1880s. And if anyone's interested in positivism, a new book has just come out on it called The Religion of Humanity by T. Wright, which is a couple of weeks ago. So what the radical working class was struggling to find at this time was a science of society, one which would explain economic exploitation, political power and historical evolution. And this was eventually to be provided in the work of Marx and Engels, which was called scientific socialism. Now, how were the working class to get hold of these ideas? How was the radical educational tradition to find expression? Well, the first point to make about this is that it was largely voluntary, informal and improvised. Education, unlike today, wasn't linked to schools. It involved a variety of institutions which together formed an educational network, a network which was going to inspire thousands of people who had never been touched, fortunately enough, by formal education. To give you some examples of this, the corresponding societies of the 1790s are often considered to be the first working class political organisations to provide an opportunity for disciplined study. And in these societies, people would meet together to read books and to discuss them. And particularly popular at this time was Tom Paine, The Rights of Man. Following on from this tradition, clubs were established where members would pay a penny a month to buy the radical press. Of course, there were meetings held on topical issues, travelling lecturers would tour the country, and people would often walk miles to hear a radical orator. The radical press was perhaps the most important means of promoting radical ideas, and as such it was a very important educational medium. And there are a number of journals at that time that are particularly interesting. For example, there's Cobbett's The Political Register, which became the Tuppenny Trash, Hetherington's Poor Man's Guardian, which on the cover of each copy it had the motto, Knowledge is Power. There was Wooler's Black Dwarf, Carlyle's Republican, O'Brien's Destructive, Doherty's Pioneer, and the Northern Star, and there were many, many more. These papers were often read aloud and discussed in pubs, reading rooms, and coffee houses. Coffee houses are quite interesting. I knew nothing about them. Apparently, there were 1,600 coffee houses in London in 1840. In these coffee shops, you could buy coffee for tuppence, and you could read a whole range of unstamped radical newspapers for a penny. It was precisely because the radical press was so important in spreading ideas that stamp duties were imposed, which not taxes on beer, but taxes on knowledge. And the unstamped press was unmercifully persecuted up and down the country. One way round this that people found was, instead of selling these papers, they would sell straws to people and give them a copy of paper free. Now, the fight for the freedom of the press then was a fight about access to knowledge and ideas. And as such, it involved people in an active struggle to change their position, and this provided an education in itself, as of course did the miners' strike provide an education for people about the role of the police in society. Along with this network of radical influences went more formalised attempts to provide counter-educational institutions. As I mentioned earlier, there were the Owenite Halls of Science, which mainly existed in the north of the country, and they provided full-time lecturers to teach both children and adults. Similarly, some of the Sunday schools were taken over, apparently, there's a bit of a debate about whether they were or not, by the working class to counter what they consider to be religious terrorism. And in this book, which is a collection of articles, there's one specifically on the Zion School in Leeds. I don't know if anyone's come across that before. There was also the Female Reform Society in Blackburn, where mothers taught their children an alternative alphabet. To give you some indication of this, B was for Bible, bishops and bigotry. K was for king, knave and kidnapper. And it went they went right through the Bible, right through the alphabet doing this. Right, okay. Let me draw this to a conclusion then. The 1870 Foster Education Act came only 3 years after the 1867 Reform Act, which had extended the vote to workers or to male workers. In his speech in the House of Commons when he introduced the bill, he said this, and I've paraphrased it slightly, he says, "We must not delay. Upon the speedy provision of elementary education depends our industrial prosperity. Upon the speedy provision depends also the safe working of our constitutional system. Now that we've given them, as working class, political power, we must not wait any longer to give them education." And I think we all know why that was and what type of education we were going to get as a result of it. So schooling was an attempt to destroy alternative forms of education to check the spread of radical ideas. In that article that I just mentioned, Simon Firth argues, "National education was not simply a matter of providing an elementary education to a class that was otherwise intellectually and morally destitute. It was, rather, a matter of providing a particular form of education to a class which had alternative forms of learning available." Now, two things developed from this. Firstly, the largest section of the labour movement, the reformist wing, began to demand equal access to facilities provided by the state. They began to associate education purely with schooling. They lost some of the radical input that had appeared earlier. On the other hand, there was a minority revolutionary tradition which continued the struggle not only for an alternative education but for an alternative society. The early socialist movement in this country saw its task as primarily educational. Its business was that of making socialists. The Democratic Federation's motto, as you're probably all aware, was educate, agitate and organise. Socialist ideas in the 1880s were spread through a variety of institutions. Firstly, there were radical clubs which developed in London particularly, and if you want to read something about that, there's this book, Club Life and Socialism in Mid-Victorian London, which is very good on this. These radical clubs became the natural habitat of politically minded workers. There was the Commonwealth Club in Bethnal Green, the Progressive Club in Notting Hill, the Free Thought Institute in Walworth, the National Secular Society and many others. And in these clubs you would get lectures on history, religion, the question of Ireland, Shelley's poetry would be read. They provided the artisans with a university. Interestingly enough, I think, in the mid-80s, these when schooling, compulsory schooling began to bite, they had difficulty getting audiences to listen to lectures. Other means that the early socialists used were open-air meetings, they held lectures and debates, they had classes and socialist Sunday schools. The Social Democratic Federation and the Socialist League probably provided the first organised classes in Marxism in this country, using wage labour and capital as a textbook. Now, the Socialist Party, I believe, has played a very important role in keeping this whole radical educational tradition alive. It's continued this battle of ideas which come from the class war. We still, as you're all obviously aware, organise conferences, hold public meetings, run outdoor meetings, publish our journal, The Socialist Standard, and pamphlets, all with the aim of spreading socialist ideas and making socialists. For us, politics and education are still linked together. They're part of the same process. This type of socialist activity, I would argue, isn't found elsewhere, or it's not found in very many places. And if you look at this month's Socialist Standard, for example, if you look at the meetings page, you'll find there are talks on religion, war, schooling, materialism, human nature. And if you look in other journals, I don't think you find that type of material being covered. I think our task, and this is perhaps where I'm going to end, it has been made more difficult by the establishment of compulsory education, because what we're dealing with today are people that are educated in the school system, and as a result of that they spend at least 15,000 hours of their early life being influenced by the schooling system. So I think that is something perhaps we could discuss. Right, yeah, I think I'll leave it there.